Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Quokka, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. The Quokka was invented in Holland in 1970. It's the best kitchen gadget up there with the cooker and the toaster. The way you say Quokka is Quokka, but it's like kind of Dutch, so I can't do it. So Quokka's, I think, the closest we'll get. And the reason why I said Quokka was I was going to say it's up there with the cooker. You can't say the cooker with the cooker. You know what I'm talking about. For more details, go to quokka.co.uk. It's Quokka, spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. And can I just thank them for sponsoring the podcast once more? I do love having them on board. I love their product. I do love their product. I really do love their product. And I love their company ethos. They're a top company. Today's hour is a conversation with ex-Special Forces Des Powell, who has written a book called Bravo 3-0. Yeah, we all remember Andy McNab's account of his SAS operation behind enemy lines in 1991 war in Iraq. But did you know there was a Bravo 1-0 and a Bravo 3-0-2? Well, Des was on Bravo 3-0, second in command. Let's find out what happened. He's written a book all about it. I must point out that the line isn't the best on this in places, but it's only a tiny little bit every now and then. It's worth hanging in there as the stories are great. Here's Des Powell. Hi, Des. How are you?
I'm very, very well, Tim. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. I was just thinking, I've read your book. I loved it. It transports me back to, I remember living in this flat and we all got a hold of Bravo 2-0 and it got passed around so quickly because I think it was the first real insight into what the SAS actually do. And the sort of, I know it's the cliche, but keeping your poo in a plastic bag and stuff was always the thing that everyone remembers, yeah, making sure you march in a line and all those things.
Yeah.
Do you think it was the first time that we got an insight really into what happened?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, when you think about it, the Gulf War, it was the first time that it was beamed into your front living room, weren't it? It was first time that people could see this war unfold. And plus the after the war, you know, the book come out, Andy McNab, you know, the Bravo 2-0. And it kind of grabbed the imagination of the public, didn't it? And I think that, people had this real insight then about the SES. It was the first time that someone had really brought this story to the forefront, you know. What a lot of people don't realise about that story is that there were actually three patrols. There was Bravo 1-0, Bravo 2-0, and obviously mine, Bravo 3-0. And a lot of people have been asking me about this lately, and they've said, Des, we're really excited about the book coming out. So, and I'm really pleased that it's come out, Tim, because now I've had permission to write it. And so I think it's a good book. I think people are going to enjoy it. And I think there's something in there for everybody.
I love it. And I'll tell you why I love it is I love the attention to detail, which I'll get into in a minute. And I think that's what I learned most about your book is there's a great story, but it's how prepared the SAS are, which is interesting. Just going back to Bravo 2-0 quickly, when it first came out, I remember there being uproar because you guys are secret and we're never allowed to know the secrets. How did you, I mean, now we've seen lots of books. I mean, I've interviewed loads of Special Forces guys on this podcast, and it's great to hear about your stories and your adventures. People love it. They always rate really highly, by the way, the podcast I do with you guys. But at the time, what did it feel like? Because you are under cloak and dagger, really, aren't you, the SAS?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, the first time anybody really saw us was the Iranian embassy, weren't it? That was the first time we'd come on film. And then everybody thought, you know, wow, who are these guys sort of thing. And then really, yeah, there'd been some books along the way, but I think Andy's book, you know, was the one that kind of, as I said earlier, it captures everybody's imagination. And yeah, we were kind of surprised that the MOD had let that book out sort of thing. But obviously you have to go through a certain procedure. You can only say so much and become sensitive. But it was a little bit strange, to say the least, yeah. And You know, I work with Andy anyhow, and I read the book, and I thought, well, yeah, maybe. We'll put it this way: it had been beamed into everybody's living room about the Gulf War, and so why not talk about the SES's involvement in the Gulf War? So, yeah, so why not?
Okay, let's talk about the missions then. Let's get a bit of background on it before we get stuck into the details of the book. So. What were the Bravo 10, Bravo 20, Bravo 3 missions? What was your missions? Why were you going behind enemy lines? Remind us.
Yeah, it was quite a simple mission, but almost impossible to bring about. The three Bravo patrols come about to find and locate mobile Scud rockets that were being fired from the Iraqi desert into neighboring countries. With an intention of bringing these countries into the conflict and destabilizing the Middle East even further. These mobile rockets were being fired from anywhere within the desert, so you could see the difficulty of it straight away. The big problem was that the leader at that time of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was very clever, and he was firing these rockets into Israel. And Israel had made it clear that they were going to come into the war. They'd put paratroopers on standby, and they were ready to parachute into Baghdad. And everyone knows that if Israel had come into the war, the dynamics of the Middle East would have changed. All the countries would have sided with Saddam, Iraq, and fought against Israel. And that would have been terrible for the Middle East. And the commanders were talking, if that happened, they were talking that the whole world would have got involved. They were in dramatic terminology, such as Third World War was coming about. Now, that sounds very dramatic, Tim, but when you're there amongst it and you actually saw how it was coming about, you actually thought, wow, this could actually happen. And then the three Bravo patrols, we thought, well, this is almost an impossible task. And there was a tongue-in-cheek type terminology of suicide patrols going out. So the scene was set, wasn't it? It was the three Bravo patrols. There was no, we used to joke about, there's no pressure on us then. We're just going to stop the Third World War from happening, Tim. And you know, so my book really is talking about the problems that not only my patrol come across through trying to prevent the Third World War, but also the other two patrols as well.
All right. So I gauge from the book that you, even though this, you know, you mentioned in the book about it being a suicide squad and everything, I sense from the book that you were actually really quite excited, though, to, you know, you've been training all this time, and it felt like you wanted to do it. You wanted to go on the mission, even though I must state, though, you do say in it, you were scared. It does feel like that is what you were trained to do and you wanted to do it. Am I right in saying that?
Exactly, Tim. I know that sounds strange. And what it is, you know, in the British military, we're soldiers. And we are designed to do a certain job. And particularly in the SES, this is our bread and butter. This was designed for us. We were covert operation, hundreds of miles behind enemy lines, trying to do whatever we can to stop more loss of life, because we could see that if this conflict escalated, it was going to be massive, Tim, absolutely massive. But yes, answering your question, we were very excited because at the beginning, our squadron wasn't in the war. We was initially, one of our squadrons, not my squadron, we was to stay in UK. Mm-hmm. And they had three squadrons, Sabre squadrons, that had been training for weeks in the Middle East that were, as we call, battle ready. But what happened all of a sudden is that one of those squadrons replaced us. And we come into the war. Initially, Tim, we were BCRs, battle casualty replacements. We were told that the SES were going to lose a lot of guys, and the two squadrons were going to fight in strength independently, moving from the Saudi border across and into Iraq and fight up independently over to Baghdad. My squadron initially was just BCRs, battle casualty replacement. So that was to replace the dead and injured of those two squadrons. But because Israel showed that it was going to come into the war and the dynamics would have changed, well, then that's when my squadron, then we formed the three Bravo patrols, and that's how it come about.
Who owns your life then? If you go in, when you're in the Special Forces, have you sort of signed a contract? You've got a wife at home, but have you signed a sort of contract with Queen and country to say, you own my life? If you tell me I'm going there on a suicide mission, you know, you're saying there that the Special Forces, the SAS, we're going to lose a lot of lives. They decided that. So your life is not your own. Your life is in the hands of the military. Is that something that you think or you're aware of? Is that how it is?
Yeah. Yes, Tim. I mean, from the beginning, when you come from, like I'd served with the Parachute Regiment for 8.5 years. And then anyone that comes from any regiment, whether it's the guards, whether it's the engineers, I come from the paras, you volunteer. It's a volunteer process to join the Special Air Service Regiment. And you have to put pen to paper. And I remember the day I put pen to paper where it said, you are now signing for operation. You're going on operations permanently. And I kind of paused and thought about it. And it wasn't that I wasn't going to sign. I was kind of thinking, wow, this, you know, my life is going to change. And yet, answering your question, you, this is your job. This is what you've signed up to do. And yes, you're in the regiment. And I suppose, yes, you can look at it that way, where they have control of your life. Yes, you do have a family. But in a way, this is the deal. Your family has to come along with what, you know, you've agreed to. You said, this is my life. This is what I want to do. I've committed to the military, not only to the military, I've committed to the regiment. And by the way, I had a great service. I served with a regiment for over 19 and a half years. So, but yes, answering your question, the deal is you put pen to paper and you have to do what you're told to do. You're a soldier at the end of the day and you have to take orders.
All right, just talking about life or death there, the thing which I've got to say really stands out for me in the book is the fact that you were in the paras three times. You've had parachute failure. Three. I mean, that is insane. Three times you've been in the air and you've had to, you're falling down, your parachute's not working. You've had to, I imagine, a matter of seconds, work out what the hell you're going to do to survive. And I mean, that, I that just makes me feel terrified thinking about it.
Yeah, I hear you. But do you know something, Tim, is that, do you know, parachuting is supposed to be one of the safest forms of, well, let's say it's a sport, but you don't hear many people actually dying from it. It's a very dangerous sport, but you don't hear many people dying from it. But saying that, when you have a malfunction, all of a sudden you say to yourself, what the hell am I doing here? And as you said there, and as you said there, I've had three of them. I had one over in Cyprus when I was training over there. I had one in Zimbabwe. I was training over there. And I had one in UK, and each time you know, you're saying, what am I doing? Seriously, Tim, you think you're going to die. But there's a certain drill, there's a certain technique, and it shows that it works, Tim, because I'm able to be here and talk to you about it and laugh about it today.
Though one of the times you described it, if I've got this right, is you have to, well, actually, a couple of times, you had to cut yourself free. Is that right?
Yes, what it is, there's a procedure that you go through. I'm not getting into much detail, but you have to cut that chute away, and there's a procedure on your harness, on your parachute harness, that you pull, and it releases the chute that you're having problems with, and then you pull your reserve chute. But right. If you pull them at the same time, obviously the chutes can tangle together. So what's actually happening is that you've had a problem with the first chute, you've got to cut it away completely, get rid of it, and then you go on to your reserve chute. And by the way, your reserve chute works every single time.
All right, it only ever fails once, put it that way. You ready?
Yeah, well, if that fails, Tim, it's not your day.
Does time slow down for you? I mean, you must have felt really alive in that. And I'm not going to give, I won't give, I'll give a lot of the book away, but not too much. When you have contact with the enemy, and they're firing at you in various different places in your life. Does time slow down for you and you're falling down a parachute and you go, hey, this is not working, I'm falling? Does like a second feel like a minute or something? Do all your senses come alive?
Yeah, you've read about this, haven't you? I have as well many times, and I would agree, it does. All of a sudden, Tim, I fell off my bike the other day. I was doing some training on my bike and everything went in slow motion then. And the thing is, yeah, I've had quite a few situations and you're right. And I've read about this. Apparently, it's your body dealing with the shock, and your body sees everything in slow time. But yes, it has done that. It did it in parachuting. It's done it when I've been out in the Gulf. You know, I think I put a few stories in the book about that. But it's happened many, many times. And I think this is a stress reaction, or so I've read anyhow, about how human beings deal with that particular thing that's happening to you at that moment in time.
Okay, let's get back to the book then, because there's three of you going out, Bravo 10, Bravo 20, and Bravo 30. Interestingly, Bravo 10 and Bravo 20 decided to do the mission on foot. Bravo 30, your one, you decided to take vehicles with you.
Yes. Yes. And some people have asked me about this. What it is, when the mission of the task comes in, you decide how you are going to do that task, that mission. And there's pros and cons of for in this case, going in on foot, going in on vehicle. And you can only go on the information that you have at that time. Two patrols decided to go in on foot. Our patrol, we decided to do vehicles. But both were viable at that time with the information that we had at that time. Now, I've given detail in the book of the reasons why people went in on foot and the reasons why we went in vehicles. But once you make that decision, Tim, you've got to go for it. And if all of a sudden you get on the ground, and when we got on the ground, we saw that it wasn't what the intelligence told us it was going to be. For example, we were told the weather, for example, was going to be a spring tight weather. Well, it was the coldest weather that Iraq had ever seen. In fact, it actually snowed. When I was out on the ground, we were told that it was undulating ground, soft underfoot, as in what we've been training in normal desert warfare. It wasn't. It was rocky. It was like a lunar landscape, you know. And so we had information that wasn't correct. There was a lot of things that wasn't correct that we had, but you just have to get on with it. There's a lot of shortfalls when you're a soldier. You can't turn around and say, well, this is too cold, or the ground's not right, or what have you. But yes, there was a lot of things intelligence-wise that had been passed on to us that wasn't correct.
So Bravo 1 and Bravo 2, they both landed with their helicopters. Andy McNabb's bunch got out and went for a stroll, and then we kind of know what happened. It's a very sad story, isn't it? Because
yes, it is. Yes,
compromised. I think that's the word you guys use. Is that the right word? Yeah. And then
yes, it is. It got compromised.
Yeah, and then a couple of guys died of hypothermia, and I mean, it's all documented, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but that's a really sad state of affairs which happened there. Bravo 10, the guy, I love the bit you write about in this, because he gets I can't remember his name now, off the top of my head, but they get out of the helicopter and go, hold on, whoa, we can't do this, and then get back in and say, drop us somewhere else. They get out and they go, wow, this is suicide mission. We really can't do this. And then there's some bit of controversy, isn't there? You know, because obviously you guys are told to be daredevils and get out there and do it. But in the book, you sort of have praise for him.
Yes, that was a brave call. And I mean, you can imagine is that we already knew that there was a lot of pressure on us. We've talked about that. And we knew that if we didn't follow through on these missions, we knew that there were going to be more loss of life. And the commander of Bravo 10 did the right thing. He got off the aircraft and saw that the information that he had wasn't correct. He got off, had a look round, and thought, no, this is... And he got back on the chopper, had a chat with a pilot and said, look, can you take us to another area? Which he did. went to another area, they got off again, had a look round. I don't know, this is not correct. This is not what we've been told. And he made a very brave call. And yes, and they got back on the chopper and came back and said that he couldn't achieve the mission. And obviously, a lot of people can look at that in a lot of different ways. I've given my opinions in the book of what I thought. And it was a very, very brave call. I think probably undoubtedly saved guys' lives by doing that. And but as you can imagine, that was a very, very difficult call. You've been ordered to go out on the ground. You've gone 100 miles behind enemy lines. You've got a task, a mission to do. He got off the helicopter, had a look round, you know, but had a chat with his patrol. They all got their head together and said, no, we can't do this. And he returned back.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we need to add into this equation is, and it made me so angry reading the book, and it does make me angry when I read a lot of these books on this thing, is we keep sending our forces out, especially you guys, with the wrong gear or not enough gear. And what really bugs me is every time you read anything about special forces, they're always asking the Americans to borrow gear or rations or whatever, because we don't have any. And it frustrates the hell out of me that the politicians will stand there and they'll say, you know, or whoever, and they'll say, we've got the finest army in the world. And you think, well, kit them out properly if you're going to send them out there. And you're going out with two crappy, well, one good vehicle, one crappy vehicle, and not enough, not enough gear. You're stealing it and borrowing it off the Americans.
That's exactly what happened. And you know something, Tim, logistically in conflict, is yes, there's always nightmares. It happens all the time. We didn't have the right cold weather equipment. We didn't have the right weapons. We didn't have enough ammunition. Our vehicles wasn't the right vehicles. And as I said, to top it all, it was the coldest weather that we'd ever had on record in Iraq. And I found myself just before going out on the ground, I thought, right, I went over, and there's a story in the book where I'm at an airbase in Saudi Arabia, and I went on the scrounge, a typical Yorkshireman, and I went to have a chat with the SEALs. Okay, there was a SEAL team there, and I used to go over and have a cup of tea with them and do some scrounging, you know. And the SEALs have got all the kit. They got everything, you know. And there's one comment from one of the SEALs. He goes, what is it with your guys? Similar to what you just said, Tim. What is it with your guys? He says, you know, he says, you're supposed to be special forces. You come out here, he says, conflict here. He says, possibly World War III. And he said, you've got no kit. So I managed to get some, yeah, I managed to get some rations off him and equipment and even some ammunition. And they were very helpful. They were great. Like, you know, giving us a tap on the back and said, best of luck, buddy, you know. And yeah, they helped us out, like, you know.
Does it annoy you, though, that, you know, you've done all this training? You're obviously, our special forces are some of the best in the world via attitude and, you know, bravery, etc. But then if you haven't got the right kit, Jesus, you know, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. Does it annoy you?
Yeah, it does. And I don't know, they've tried to alleviate it over the years. I think probably, Tim, I always add this, is that we're always short on equipment, because one simple thing is that things happen so fast, so fast. And sometimes the logistics don't move fast enough to marry up with us going out on the ground. For example, you know, I was on the ground within days after leaving UK. Within days, I was 100 miles behind enemy territory, and the equipment that we needed, especially cold weather equipment, didn't come in time. In fact, even the two Sabre squadrons, they didn't have cold weather gear anyhow. In fact, the regimental sergeant major, partway through the conflict, went in Saudi, I think it was to Al Jouf, went to the market, the souks, and bought a load of coats, and actually put them on a helicopter on resupply for the two squadrons that were crossing over the border, and actually gave them coats. And there's a joke about one of my mates afterwards said, oh, by the way, there was a package for you which says Dez Powell's cold weather gear. And he says, thanks very much, Dez. He says, that kept us very, very warm. So, yeah, it's logistically, we always have problems, Tim. We're trying to... you know, alleviate this, but it, it always seems to happen. And I think one of the things is that things happen so fast that we don't always have the equipment that we need for the task in hand.
Yeah, and one of the things which really comes across in the book is that one of your jobs is to assess problems constantly and work out what the next plan is and what you should do. And so what I really like about the book is you're always doing the two decisions that you had to make, and you're all discussing it and going, should we do this or should we do that? Should we do this or should we do that? And then how you get round to the decision. And I really like that. I think that's an important part of the book, that, you know, it isn't all taught to you. There are parts where you have to use your own initiative.
Yeah, I agree on that, Tim. And when you're in a patrol, whether it's, you know, in this case, it was an 8-man patrol, 2 4-man patrols, you know, together. And probably just the best way to answer that. One evening, you know, as you can just to set the scene, it was snowing. And we felt really bad. We could feel ourselves going down with hypothermia. We know things are not good. And suddenly we're seeing explosions in the distance. And we knew it was Baghdad getting pounded, getting attacked. And we just sat there, Tim, quietly. We didn't say anything. And we could see explosions going off. We could see that Baghdad was taking a hell of a pounding. And we knew that people was getting injured and killed. And we didn't say anything till the next day. And we all got our heads together. I had a conflab, you know, just as you just said there, and said, look, whatever we do, we've got to try our very best to try and alleviate what we've seen this evening, because if this escalates further, there's going to be thousands of people's lives at risk. So it's that old saying, it's better to have tried and failed than not to have tried at all. So we had our heads together and we just said, let's try our very best. No matter what shortcomings we've got, we haven't got the right equipment, the vehicles, weapons, ammunition, stuff like that. But guess what? When I say soldiers, let's get on with the job. You know, let's stop whinging and whining and belly aching attitude, and let's get on with it. And that conflab kind of morale-wise cheered us up. The patrols always do that. It's not just the commander that makes the decision. It's the whole patrol team.
Mm. Do you look back fondly on the mission? I know it's a weird thing to say because Bravo 2-0 had such a horrific time, but do you look back because it's what you were paid to do? Do you look back and go, wow, that was one hell of an adventure I had, and sort of have fond memories of it?
That's strange, isn't it? I mean, we guys in the regiment, you form bonds like families, you know, and when you're in, you know, dire situations like that and you're relying on each other, you're relying on, you know, and keeping each other alive, you form bonds that cannot be broken. So you look back and have you noticed, Tim, sometimes the most difficult situations that you've had in your life kind of make you stronger, and you tend to remember them better, sort of thing. Just to go on a little bit there, there were one evening when we felt really, really bad. And we, as you know, the transmissions wasn't getting through. Mm. And we had a garbled transmission, and we were almost certain that two or three patrols, including Bravo 2-0, we wasn't quite sure, but we said it's possibly had been hit. And we said to ourselves, if we're having problems in vehicles, imagine what they're having on foot. And we felt quite bad because our comrades were either possibly in dire straits, maybe on the run. We didn't know at that time, but we couldn't do anything. We didn't know where they were. We were working independently. They could have been anywhere in the desert. We couldn't get in touch with them, but we just felt that we wanted to do something and we couldn't. And we'd also heard that from the other squadrons that they'd been attacked and possibly guys had been killed. So the bonds in the regiment are very, very close. And that evening, I remember none of us felt good. We knew that guys were possibly on the run and guys had been killed. You find that you look back on these situations and you have mixed feelings, you know, of kind of fondness, but also of, oh, you know. But as I've said before, those periods in your life that were very, very bad, you tend to come out of them and it makes you stronger and you look at them differently, don't you, Tim?
Definitely. There's this three parts to your book that I thought that really struck me. I'm going to run through them. The first one is trust. because you talk about that there, we might as well get into this, that there's this brilliant, and it goes two ways. There's this brilliant bit in the book where you start talking through everyone in your troop, in the patrol.
Yeah.
Everyone in the patrol. I always get in so much trouble, Des. If ever I get one terminology, calling Jason Fox SAS rather than SBS, I got in so much crap for that.
You're not going to get that from me today, Tim.
All right. Well, so trust seems really important. And it, as I say, it goes both ways. You go through working out if you're going to end up in a gunfight here when certain circumstances happen, what these guys in your patrol are capable of. But also, I imagine you want your second in command, you want your guys, the other seven of them, to trust you too. And God, no one, like, I work in TV, I sort of have a little bit of trust from my co-presenter, but it's not life or death. It doesn't, the producer and the auto cue, but I don't have that. That must be such an important thing when you look around at the rest of the patrol going, do we trust each other?
Yeah, you know that story what I just said, we all had a bit of a conflab. In a way, Tim, that was kind of a chance for guys to say, you know, look, you know, we're not achieving anything. And we did, we had conversations that, we'd seen Scud locations and we'd sent back the coordinates, but we weren't sure whether those were getting through, the messages were getting through. We were bumping into people every day out in the desert, and we were just pretending to be Iraqi soldiers. The good thing about the Iraqi army at that time is there were lots of troops, lots of vehicles, and lots of different uniforms. We were on our two vehicles, which were all cammed up the best we could, and we were wearing shemags. But we were trying our best to get through this mission the best we can. But the trust with the guys is that, you know, we speak to each other and we trust each other and say, hey, you know, what do you think? Do you think we should do this? Do you think we should do that? And like at one stage we were saying, well, look, if we don't achieve the mission, if we don't find, you know, the Scud missiles that we've been sent out to do, do we do a big spectacular? Do we go and attack someplace and then make a run for it to the border? But we know that wasn't going to achieve very much. Remember, Tim, that wasn't our mission. Our mission was to find these Scud missiles and send the coordinates back. Yes, answering your question, the trust within the guys is very, very important. You're trusting the guy with your life, but you trust as well that you're not making the wrong decision. You know, you say, look, mate, I think we should do this. Do you think that's a good idea? So you basically get around, have a conflab, have a chinwag, and just say, right, what's the best way we can do this? And you've got to trust that the guys, you know, if a guy says, look, we're not doing anything, let's get back. Well, then you've got to think about that. You know, you've got to think, well, maybe we're not achieving anything. As it happened, you know, we said, right, let's crack on. Let's do the best we can.
How does it work when you go from being in a situation like that in the forces to being back in civvy life? And everyone's a bloody liar, and everyone's out. Is it hard to get back into civvy life and civilian life and just kind of act normal? Because you know you all trust each other so much that is it a bit weird?
Yeah, he says, my son has a great one. He goes, Dad, he says, there's idiots everywhere, isn't there? I go, yeah, but I says, you've got to deal with them. I says, I think what it is, Tim, just deal with like-minded people. All my friends that I deal with are all good friends, all like-minded, all on the same page. And I think that's what you've got to do. You've got to mix with people that are like you. It's a fact of life, Tim. You're just not going to get on with everybody, are you? And yeah, you know, you've just said something there, you know, people, you know, can't say liars, but they fib, don't they? They don't say the right thing and you can't rely on them. And in the military, no one lies, you know, you can rely on them 100%. And as you said, you talked earlier on about the trust, you know, they've got your back. It's as simple as that. So what I find is I mix with like-minded people the best I can.
But when you got into security, for instance, I mean, that again can be a life and death situation. If someone wants to kill one of the stars you're hanging out with, or, you know, you're trying to do, are you then looking around for the like-minded people to work with, then going, well, I need people that I can trust because this is a situation where we're dealing with security. And then is that what you did? You had to try and surround yourself with like-minded people in that as well?
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, when you are with, you know, I did some celebrity stuff, and firstly, you know, if I'm with that celeb, I explained the situation to him, and I said, look, this is how I would like to go about it, because I'm trying to make sure that you stay safe. So I've got to have him on board. And then if I can, sometimes his closer team, the people that work with him, I'll explain them. A lot of it is just getting them on the right page, Tim. Is just getting them in that frame of mind, because, you know, they don't understand. You know, people don't know about VIP security, obviously not. So, yeah, the best I can is I get like-minded people on board. I explain the situation to them, bring them around. And the people that help me, I make sure that they are good quality people too.
Yeah. How easy is VIP celebrity security?
It's difficult because, you know, celebrities, you know, just the term itself, they want to be out in front. They want to deal with people. Probably the best way for me to explain this is I've looked after businessmen, and of course they looking after them is far, far easier, because they just want to do the job in hand and not be seen. But a celebrity is completely different. They're out there, they're well known, they've got to be with their public. So security for them is very, very difficult.
Who are some of the celebrities you work for?
Okay, let me think. Right, in football, I've looked after Jamie Redknapp, Robbie Keane, Les Ferdinand. In the pop world, Christine Aguilera, Rod Stewart. In films, I've been on the Bond films. I've looked after Piers Brosnan and Ali Berry. Let me think, on TV, Jim Davison, Jeremy Kyle, to name just a few.
Do you have to cross the line? Are you allowed to be their friend, or do you have to kind of keep a little bit of a distance?
We call it the red carpet. Don't get on the red carpet. So no, don't become their friends. And it's, you know, I explained that to him. I said, look, this is the job I've got to do. There's sometimes I'm going to tell you off if you don't mind. And or at the end of the day, we'll lessons learned. I'll say, don't do that again. You know, because and sometimes we have a bit of an argument. We have a few words. Yeah, you know, I'm a Yorkshireman. Yeah. So I say, as it is, Tim. But it's for their benefit, Tim. And you know, some, the vast majority of people I've come across get it, understand it.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's, I quite enjoyed that, actually, you know.
Getting back to being out on mission and everything, I'm talking about trust. One of the big things, it seems, and you talk about it a lot through the book, is humor. And it seems that if you're in the forces, you got to have thick skin, because you were going to get hammered for every little bit of anything, any little cracks in your armor, people are going to go for, aren't they? And I suppose that in a way that toughens you up and also gives you another trust thing, does it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, in the military, we have, you know, they call it dark humor, don't they? And in the regiment, we can call it black humor. And you normally find when things get a bit tense, when things get a bit scary, guys tend to crack more jokes. And what that is, that's just releasing tension, Tim. And you understand it. And we have a term called banter in the military, where you're basically taking the mickey out of each other all the time, you know, and it is just great humor. And it's as simple as this. If you can't take it, don't give it. And, you know, me being a Yorkshireman, you know, they talk about flat caps and whippets and pigeon fancying and stuff like that. You know, in the patrol, we've got a Geordie boy, so we're talking about him. We've got a guy from Liverpool, so we're talking about the Beatles. You know, what was it like being in the Beatles?
Yeah.
But a lot of it as well, Tim, is raising morale. When you have a bit of a laugh and the humour comes out, it releases the tension is one, and it raises morale the other. But it's as simple as this, mate. If you can't take the mickey taking, well, then you best not be in the military, because everything is just great banter. It's great humor, Tim.
Yeah. Well, you say that, raising the morale. Are the other things, so the three things that are important that I got from your book, one, the first one's trust. The second one is conquering your fears. And you know, you're in a parachute, it doesn't work, you got to cut it away and use the reserve. God knows how you get do that. It's just, I mean, that's, I'd be terrified. But also, you know, what I love about your book is you openly admit there's times where you're kind of a bit scared, and you, but that is what being I suppose that's what life is often, isn't it? It's just conquering your fears. It's just a very extreme version with you, because you could die.
Yeah, it is, Tim. I think I've never come across anyone in the regiment that says they're not scared. We all said that. And it's a normal reaction to most things, isn't it? You know, and I don't think you'll fully conquer it. I think you learn to channel it, you know. And it's, you know, people said to me, what's the most scary thing that you've done? And we've come back to parachuting again. The most scary thing within the regiment, Tim, I joined Air Troop, which is high altitude free fall parachuting. And that's jumping with oxygen. Just to set the scene, you're on a military aircraft, normally a C-130, a Hercules, 25,000 feet up in the air. You are breathing on oxygen. You have got all your military kit strapped to your body, including your weapon and your burden, about 200 pounds. You are breathing oxygen. You will have a team of 4 or 6 or 8. And it's normally done at night. And then you jump off the tailgate and you are free falling for approximately 2 minutes. And you are reaching speeds of 120 mile an hour or more. And it's normally cold, your altimeters freeze up, your goggles freeze up, you can't see anything, your breathing equipment doesn't work, and you're in the sky, and if you bump into each other, you're going to have a fatality. And then you are ready for your chute to deploy at round about 3,000 feet, 3,500. And anybody that's in Air Troop that says they're not scared doing that, well, then they're definitely a liar. And when people ask me what's the most scared, every single time I've done that, Tim, and I think there's a story in the book when we do it out in a cold country.
Yeah.
And we did that, and it was 30 below, Tim, 30 below. So everything was freezing up. And even in free fall, then, if you're traveling under 20 miles an hour, 140, 150 miles an hour going through the sky, well, then you have a wind chill and it will go even, you know, the temperature will plummet even more. And everything is not working. And luckily, I survived that as well. But I remember coming under the chute and it was that cold. You reach up for your toddles on your chute so you can steer it. And I couldn't feel my hands, and I couldn't feel my feet either. And plus the story, we won't give it away, Tim, will we? The story is that the wind is blowing me off course into another country. And we were concerned that me and my patrol was going to cross into another country, which we shouldn't have. And anyhow, that's free fall parachuting with oxygen at night, 25,000 feet. Screaming towards the earth, 2 minutes of free fall is not everybody's cup of tea, Tim. And it scares me every single time. But yes, as far as adrenaline rush, it's about the best you're going to get.
I'll tell you, Des, you have felt alive, that's for sure. I mean, you really have felt alive in your life. When the rest of us are sitting on a sofa, you know, watching some rubbish TV, or we're actually watching Netflix for our adrenaline, you've actually lived it. that's what you've done. You've actually been like Tom Cruise in the bloody Mission Impossibles and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
what I quite like, though, as you say, that is channeling the fear. What's great is in the book, you do your thought processes. It's really good, the book, by the way, and really lovely read, because you do your thought processes and then it always ends with the same thing. You talk to yourself, come on, Des, let's get this done. Let's have a cup of tea. Go get home, have a cup of tea, get some medals. But it's always the way you do it. It's like, right, I'm scared. I don't know what's happening. Channel it. Let's go and do it. That's the option. Let's do it. And you know, those who hesitate, I suppose, are the ones who end up.
On that one, Tim. Yeah, I suppose the way you've got to look at it, or the way I always thought, whenever a tense situation comes about, You just have to accept it. You go, well, here I am. This is what I've chose. You know, I volunteered to be here. I don't have to be here if I don't want to. And when something come about which is a little bit tense, as you know, there's a story in the book where I kind of have a mantra, don't I? And yeah. I have some dog tags around my neck. And on your dog tags, it has your name, rank, number. And what I do just to focus myself when it gets a little bit tense is that I just put my hand on my chest where the dog tags are. And I just have a little word with myself. And I just say, right, Des, come on, let's get the job done. Let's get this done. Let's do a good job. And let's get home and have a cup of tea. And it just focuses me. And in fact, there's funny stories in the regiment where guys tend to say, there's a saying which says, right, let's get the job done. Let's get home and let's have to your medals.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat similar to that. It's a tongue in cheek. But it's again, it's showing that the guys are human. We're scared, we everything we do, but Tim, if we're there, you've got to get on with the job, because guess what, if you don't like it, nobody's forcing you to be there, are they? And you can get out.
You've added a bit to, I always use this thing which I talked about in this podcast a lot, it's called ARM, A-R-M, and it's accept, which we basically, you've just said, accept the situation, then take responsibility, whatever it is, whether you've got a parking ticket or you're being shot at by the enemy. Take responsibility that you got yourself in this, whatever happens. And then the M is move on, make the decision, move on and work out what you're going to do. And I always live my life like that. And that's interesting. I've never had to do a life or death situation yet.
You said something earlier on, Tim, about we've lived life and what have you. And in the book, you know, I'm a big one for saying. So, you know, I can see a poem or a saying and I write them down, and it tends to stir you, doesn't it? I mean, you've only got to think of Churchill and Orwell and, you know, the Invictus, you know, all of those. Yeah. And there was a South African guy once, and he said something to me, and he'd worked for a special forces group. And he told me this saying, and it, you know, and I thought, wow, I like that. And it goes like this. It's you haven't lived until you've almost died. And for those that fight for it, life has a flavor all of its own that the weak and timid shall never know. And when he told me that, I went, wow. And I actually got it off him word for word. And as you can see, I know it for word. And it's brilliant. And it always, I think, wow. And that what we're saying there is that to join the regiment, Tim, is not for everybody. I talk to people now, and the thought of joining the regiment is far easier than actually doing it, you know, and the selection process to get this type of person, if you like, as you can appreciate, the job we do is very, very difficult, and it's not for everyone. So there is a selection process, and the selection process, that's what they call it. They don't call it the SAS test. They call it SAS selection, and it's a volunteer process. And when you come up and go through this process, this selection, which takes 6 months, it actually selects you. All the instructors do is just make sure that this process is carried out. And what they found, Tim, is that if you get a certain individual and you put them under heavy physical stress, you put them under heavy mental stress, and then you put them under sleep deprivation stress, and you do that over 6 months, the real person will come through. As you can appreciate, Tim, me and you can go on a course and we can smile and say the right things at the right time and do the, as we call it, a tick in the box. But when you have a process like that, no, the real you will come through. And the selection process selects you and says, this is the right type of person that we need in the SAS, because the jobs that we come about in the SAS are always difficult. When you think about it, most situations that we are put in is a negative situation, but it's expected to bring about a positive outcome. And not sounding a big one, Tim, but you need a certain type of guy to do that. And I think in the book, I think I've stressed that this with our patrol at the time, all the three Bravo patrols, is that whether we win or whether we fail, we've tried our best. And through trying our best, as you know, we've talked about a patrol that guys committed the ultimate sacrifice, Tim. And you can't ask any more than that from a guy. Would you agree?
I agree. Yeah, totally. And Des, you love the selection process so much. You put yourself through it twice. Read the book to find out that, but it just sounds horrific. Right. We've only got an hour, and that's how I like to do it these days. So I'm just going to run through my third thing that I've learned from your book. The first was trust. The second was conquering or channeling your fears, as you said it. And the third, which is the thing that I learned most from reading your book, is preparation. And that is the job of the selection process, making sure they've got the right people on board. And then that is the great thing about reading your book, I think, the constant attention to detail that you guys have, and you've put it in your book fantastically. You get off, you know, you're going to set camp up for the night. You try and dig a trench. I mean, to most of us, to dig a trench would take a whole day. You're trying to do that just before you go to sleep because you know, you don't want to be compromised. You want to do that. You've learned how to parachute, obviously. You've learned medicine. You've worked in the A&E to learn medicine. You know, you've learned how to even ramming car training. I mean, the attention to detail is unbelievable. And I think that preparation seems to be one of the keys to be a successful special forces personnel.
Yes, I think that the regiment itself, the success of the regiment is that we haven't become a dinosaur. In other words, we're always learning new techniques. We realize that we must go forward. So sometimes we are the guys that try it for the first time, and it doesn't always work. For example, we'll try a weapon system. And if we don't like that weapon system, we'll say, no, we don't like it. And we'll try weapons from Germany, from all over the world. And we'll say, no, that weapon, we don't like it because it doesn't fit to that task. We'll try certain vehicles, you know, we'll try those. No, we don't like those vehicles, these equipment. So what we do is that we just try and better ourselves all the time. And I think that's the success of the regiment, is the attention to detail. Try it. If it doesn't work, get something else, put it in its place. Yeah, but does that work? No. What about that? No, that doesn't. And the regiment, I think, Tim, is very, very good at that, because, yeah, we often use that term, is that if we don't keep going, we'll become like the dinosaur, and everybody knows what happened with the dinosaur. Yeah.
And, Are you still in contact with the regiment? For the rest of your life, is it like a gang you're in and that's it? Or are you spewed out the other end?
Answer to that, I was going through selection and a friend was encouraging me, and he was already there. We'd been in Pararege together. And he was telling me, look, you're going to do this and you're going to do that and you're going to have a great time. And, you know, and he said one thing, which I didn't really understand at that time. He says, remember this, Des. He says, even when you get out of the regiment, you're still SAS. And I didn't understand what he said. And probably what I've noticed is this, is that in the military, when you tell anyone you're going for selection, you're going for SAS, it's a big deal. Okay, people respect that, you know, you are committing not just to go and do a course, you're committing to an all different lifestyle. And what I've noticed since the book is coming out, and since I've followed this, is that here in terminology, we use Civvy Street, here in Civvy Street, is also a big deal. And the respect that people give you is immense. I know that wherever I go, behind me is those three big letters. And there's a certain protocol that I must follow. There's a certain way I must act and a certain way I must speak and a certain way I must present the regiment, if you like, in good light. And answer to your question, you're always SAS. And I didn't realize that until you actually get out. I keep in touch with as many guys as I can. Everybody's just all over the world, and it's nice to catch up with them. Everybody's living their own lives. And it's nice to see a lot of them have gone on to successful civil lives, you know. But yeah, answering your question again, once you join the regiment, you're always in the regiment.
Just going back to the attention to detail just quickly. What I loved was the fact that you, just before you went out on mission, you all had a go just reminding yourself how to use the Oppo, the enemy's weapons, just in case you end up having to use those, just to remind yourself that, I mean, that is the attention to detail that I absolutely love. Just in case, we better know, we better remind ourselves how to use these weapons. It's, that sort of stuff's amazing.
Yeah, it is. You are continuously training and retraining, because you just mentioned a lot of stuff that we do there, and you can't keep it up all the time, Tim, because you are all over the world, you're on different tasks, you are on a different training cycle, you have training cycles, you have operational cycles, you've got a fit leave in between as well with your family. But you find you are retraining all the time. And what was nice when I first joined the regiment, I didn't know about certain weapon systems and what have you. And there was an SES instructor then. I was the new boy on the block. And there was a lot of old and bald, as we called them then. And we just got round in a circle. And the instructor just said, right, we're going to go through this weapon system. I realize everybody's been all over the world. Some of you may not have touched this for quite a while. I'm going to start right from the beginning. And he started from basics. I thought, wow, that mindset is just brilliant. Instead of being the beginner and saying, right, everybody should know you've done this before. Well, no, you might not have touched that weapon system for a year. And in some cases, 2 years. I know guys that haven't parachuted for over a year, 2 years, simply because they've been on operations around the world. And you are always, always retraining. And nobody is scared to put their hand up and go, sorry, mate, I haven't done this weapon for ages. Can you start from the beginning? And I like that attitude. It's brilliant, you know.
Des, can you still deliver a baby?
Oh, I can't remember where I put that in the book. But what happened was I went on a hospital attachment and they said, Des, try and do everything you can. Do everything. Obviously, you work down in A&E most of the time. But I got round the hospital as much as I could. I've done a few hospital attachments. And I am proud to say that I've helped deliver at least 3 babies.
Yes. But it's amazing that even that attention to detail, to go and work in a hospital, learn how to do it just in case, you know, in case someone gets injured or hit. It's great. I mean, I know that just seems so obvious, but until you start reading your book, you just don't realize that you've been actually gone to that much detail. They've actually gone and worked in a hospital or been in a hospital to get involved. Yeah.
By the way, on that one, Tim, one of my friends, he went on a hospital attachment. He was trying to get his wife to the hospital in time. She was going into labor, couldn't do it. In the car, he delivered the baby in the car.
Perfect.
So brilliant, you know.
Finally, the one of the big ones that really occurred to me when I was reading your book, because it's an adventure and it's such a great book to read, these sort of things, because it's something that I would never go through. I hope I don't, because it is, you know, it's traumatic, some of the stuff you have to go through. But at the end, you and your mates are looking up, and the patrol, you're looking up and you see this beautiful red sunset. And sort of the way the book comes across is you get taken away from your mission slightly, and you're looking going, wow, we're sort of like, you know, this is it, we've done the mission and everything else. Is there a time where you sort of, at that stage, you sort of look back and go, what is this all about? What is going on here? Why are we, or do you, what is the emotions when you actually get taken away from the bit where you're really focused in on your mission and everything?
Yeah, I remember that part of the story. It's, I remember that all of a sudden we were extracting ourselves, but we were actually on the run. We're trying to get away from the enemy. We've been compromised. But all of a sudden, there was kind of a lull. And all of a sudden, the weather didn't seem too cold. The terrain didn't seem too bad. And we just kind of had a moment, if you like. And yeah, the sunset looked really appealing. And we just stood and looked at it. And I think it was reflection, all of us. We all kind of glanced at each other. And it was the sketch of, well, we've actually got through this, or it looks like we may get through this, because there were times, Tim, I honestly didn't think we were. And then all of a sudden, when you do have a reflection like that, you really get a nice feeling, a warm feeling, and say, you know, we actually did it. You know, we achieved our mission, or we achieved it to the best of our ability. And what was good at that time is that that no one was hurt. You know, no one was killed. We know that guys had been killed, had been injured. And at that stage, the patrol was intact. So we're having a bit of a moment. We're having a bit of a reflection. And yeah, it was just maybe we just get through this.
There's my final thing is there a place for special forces in the future? You look at war now, we've just seen on the news, China have this hypersonic missile, which can actually, I don't know, leave the atmosphere, go around and kill us within minutes. You know, they've been testing it in nuclear. We've got drones, which we know are going to go in, and we've got robots now. You know, the Boston Dynamics are sending in dog robots and things like that. Do you still think there's a place for special forces to send humans into behind enemy lines and go on missions like that?
Yes, without a doubt, is that warfare has got far too technical now, hasn't it? And I was talking to a pilot, and he was talking about the aircraft, how technical it is, but he was saying that it can't move faster than the human being that controls it, okay? And he was saying that sometimes we're getting far too technical, that the aircraft is spending more time in the shop, okay, getting repaired than it is out on the ground. And I think the old-fashioned, as we call it, going back to boots on the ground and going back to our map and compass will always be there. You've always got to have guys on the ground. For example, look at those Bravo 3-0 there. They was talking about Third World War. They were talking about Scud missiles. No matter how much aircraft they had, I mean, one night there were over 570 odd sorties went into Baghdad, you know, and they still couldn't find or bomb these Scud missiles. We had to go in on foot or on vehicle and find these. So no matter how technical things get, or no matter how hyper or how good, you're still going to need the old-fashioned SES guy on the ground to win the day.
Des, that's a great way to end this. Thank you so much for joining us. Your book, Bravo 3-0, is out now, and I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much, Des.
Tim, thank you very much for having me on today. I've really enjoyed talking to you.